KALW.
All of them were taken by surprise by the school list that he released on October 8th.
The way San Francisco's school district is handling potential school closures is raising concerns.
It was not according to the plan that they thought that there was agreement with.
Today, a tangled timeline and confusion inside SFUSD. Then we visit a basement venue that's kept local music alive in the Bay Area for over 100 years.
When you open the door, it's like stepping back in time.
And we'll hear the story of an 89-year-old casino dealer who was once a Broadway ballet dancer.
He is able to get into the School of American Ballet, where he's surprised to learn he's the only person of color.
Coming up, a new film tells his life story. I'm Hanat Baba, and this is Cross Currents. The San Francisco Unified School District is looking into closing some of its schools. It's called the Resource Alignment Initiative. On October 8th, Mission Local published a list of schools the district identified as meeting their criteria to be merged or closed. But the long-awaited notice was released weeks past the due date and turned out to be just preliminary. Once again, SFUSD parents, students, and educators are left waiting with more questions than answers. Even San Francisco Mayor London Breed weighed in this week, stating that she has, quote, lost confidence in Superintendent Matt Wayne's ability to manage the current process.
The date that we were supposed to learn the fate of what schools were on the chopping block was September 18th. But shortly before that time, the superintendent in the district said that that deadline would not be met.
That was Joe Eskenazi, Mission Local's senior editor, who's been following this story. To help untangle how we got here, he speaks with KALW News editor Sunni Khalid.
Tell me, what happened Tuesday night? Is this political grandstanding by Mayor Breed before the election? What exactly is going on?
I mean, there's certainly a political element to it, but that doesn't mean that it won't affect the very real process of proposed closures of schools. What happened was that Mayor Breed very forcefully came out against the closure process, claiming that it was fatally flawed, and also really a visceral attack on Superintendent Matt Wayne, who has been leading this process. She said she lost his confidence to do this and that the process must end and that all it's doing right now is harming families.
Well, what power does she have over SFUSD?
On paper, less than you'd think, but the world doesn't exist on paper. Among other things, on September 22nd, the school board took the extraordinary step of asking the mayor for help in this situation, and she reciprocated by freeing up $8.5 million of unallocated funds, and also directing a team of, I think they call them a school stabilization team, a SEAL Team 6 of education, if you will, to go in there and kind of help Matt Wayne, the superintendent, out and look over his shoulder. They do not have jurisdiction. So in the end, they don't actually control this situation, but there's a lot of political pressure that can be leveled up one way or the other.
He hasn't been in office that long.
He came in during a difficult time after the pandemic and during the rather difficulty-plagued reign of Superintendent Vince Matthews. He came in, and you might recall that one of the rallying cries of the recall of the school board is that you didn't want the former school board voting on who the next superintendent would be. Well, they recalled the school board, and those people, the new people, brought in this guy.
Well, you also told me that the school board could have voted to dismiss Matt Wayne recently.
They could have on September 22nd, but they opted not to. And instead, they took that step of asking the city for help, which is unusual because these are two separate entities. I can tell you that the latest development that I reported on is that Mr. Wayne appears to have really alienated the mayor, the mayor's school stabilization team, and perhaps every member of the Board of Education. Because what I'm told by a number of people is that all of them were taken by surprise by the school list that he released on October 8th. It was not according to the plan that they thought that there was agreement with. And what the school board and the mayor and the mayor's people thought would happen is that there would just be a list of vulnerable schools and that would be all. That's not the list that was released. The list that was released had 11 schools that would be closed, and it listed the destinations where the students would be merged. This circumscribes any kind of conversation you're going to have about what you do. It kind of makes it a done deal. Not a lot of wiggle room for the impacted school families. And, you know, whether it's political pressure that the mayor didn't want this kind of list out before the election, or just the fact that everybody says they were blindsided, it was a curious move. And it seems to have, in one stroke, really blown up a bridge with just about everybody else involved in this process.
Was this announcement leaked intentionally, or did it just leak out through disaffected segments inside the administration?
So the actual list itself was something that a number of journalists obtained and Mission Local obtained first and printed first. And because it differed so greatly from what people in the mayor's office and the mayor's team and the Board of Education believed was coming, they thought this was an erroneous list. And they, I am told, went so far as to begin doing work to try and do damage control because of this leak of this erroneous list that's causing fear among families. But it turns out not to have been an erroneous list. Our article and everyone else's article was accurate.
You have three children in San Francisco Unified School District. What is your reaction as a parent to this boondoggle?
I accept the arguments in the abstract about there being a diminishing number of students and too many schools and a spreading of resources too thinly. But the criteria they used to decide which schools to cut and the way in which they interfaced with the parents and the opaque nature of the process was unacceptable. And if it wasn't designed to drive people to despair and to rage, it certainly had that effect in practice. And this budget deficit is something that can't be put off to later, even which school closures theoretically could be. We need by November to submit a preliminary budget and by December to finalize it. Otherwise, the state will quite possibly come in and begin dictating what we do and don't do. So that's a really pressing concern, as is passing the school bond. That's something that this is certainly not helping. And finally, this district is struggling to get in place a new overall operating system that would replace the terrible payroll system that caused so many nightmares and shortchanged the teachers and drove them into other jobs. So those are a lot of pressing things to do. And it remains questionable whether the district has the bandwidth to do all of that and close schools with a process that people feel is equitable and honest and thorough and fair.
That was Mission Local's senior editor Joe Eskenazi speaking with KLW News editor Sunni Khalid. SFUSD's final list of potential school closures is expected to go to the Board of Education November 12th and put to a vote on December 10th. Find all our coverage of SFUSD at klw.org/crosscurrents. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. Up next, we've got a story from our series Culture Keepers, celebrating the Bay Area's unique spaces and communities.
People just look at it like you're just driving a piece of junk on the streets. But to us, it's like a canvas on wheels.
There's a lot of dirt, rocks, love, and sweat. Maybe a couple of cigarettes.
Do coffee. Do something. No rights reserved, no wrongs preserved.
I felt like I was with my people.
Live music is quintessential to any city's nightlife, but increasing rents and impacts of the pandemic have made it difficult for small venues around the Bay Area to stay open. Slim's, Amado's, and Starline Social Club are among the number of beloved local concert spaces that have closed in recent years. But today, we'll visit a venue in San Francisco that's been keeping local music alive in the Bay Area for over 100 years. KLW's Aru Nair has the story.
In a basement in the Castro, there's a concert space that's introduced audiences to performers who have gone on to worldwide fame. And a swelling rage. Mumford & Sons played there in 2008. Then 2 years later, Janelle Monáe came through. And in 2012, Sarah Bareilles performed at the venue. The place is Café du Nord. I meet up with the show manager, Dan Strickland, when the club is quiet.
It's pretty common people come here for the first time. They're like, oh, this place feels like it's haunted, and I don't believe in ghosts.
But he's heard some weird sounds here, too.
But I think what they're picking up on is more of just you can feel the history. I think that's what people, they're feeling that sort of energy that a space has, and this place has a lot of it.
It's existed on Market Street for over 115 years. Café du Nord served as a speakeasy during the Prohibition era, a Scandinavian restaurant, even a gentleman's club, allegedly.
When you open the door, it's like stepping back in time. It's like stained glass and these big high-backed, I call them Viking chairs, but I don't think that's what they're called. But it just kind of has that Viking air about it.
It kind of does have a Viking air. It was the Swedish Society of San Francisco who constructed the building in 1907, and it's had Scandinavian ties ever since.
I've also seen a Christmas ceremony in here, too, like with girls in white robes with candles on their head. First time I saw that, I was like, thought I'd step straight into a midsummer, you know, kind of ritual.
This was a place for the Scandinavian community to gather.
This is a city that's always drawn immigrants, so coming to a foreign place and having some of your people from your country to help you get a job and get housing and, you know, and gather and in your community. That's pretty cool.
But what has allowed Café du Nord to stay alive for so long? Well, the community ethos the space was built on has been carried forward because of the venue's emphasis on supporting artists from the local community.
Do you miss me when you think of San Francisco?
On the night I'm here, the opening act is the band Mare. Jess Cognier is the lead singer.
Playing Café du Nord is huge to me. I mean, I feel like this represents a leg up in Mare's ability as an artist, and I hope that it will be remembered as like a turning point for us on our road to bigger things.
Local music has always been an integral part of Du Nord's history.
And as long as I've been here since, you know, and as far as I know, even from the late 80s, early 90s, it's always been a spot for local music.
This is Graham LeBron, Café du Nord's production manager. He's been coming to the venue since 1999, when he first moved to California.
We do a lot of outside shows. We do a lot of touring bands, and that's part of what this venue is about. But I do think a key part of it is going to be making sure that we're still connected to the city of San Francisco and the surrounding areas. I want to make sure that we're supporting local artists. I want to make sure that those people have a place to play so that they can open for a touring band. And maybe next time then they're headlining and then they can have their friends in the younger bands. And it's just like this ecosystem of building artists and just building a community so that it keeps sustaining.
Part of how they keep this ecosystem going is by keeping it accessible. It's right in the middle of the city. They offer underage shows and have comparatively low ticket prices. And the small size of the venue might actually work in Café du Nord's favor.
I really love the intimacy of the space.
This is Kat. She's a 41-year-old living in the Soma neighborhood of San Francisco.
It's no bad spot to stand, no matter where you are, to be able to see the music. You can hear the band, you feel close to the band, and it feels like a site with history, which is also just a great part of the San Francisco scene.
And intimate is the right word to describe tonight's headlining act, In the Valley Below. It's Du Nord's small space that allows In the Valley Below to come down from the stage to the floor, where people gather to watch them perform. The duo's stage is set like a dining room in a home, with candlesticks on white tablecloths and glass chalices. Singer and keyboardist Angela Mattson has her hair in pigtails. Her movements are amplified by her flouncy white dress. Jeffrey Mendel, who sings and plays guitar, wears a cream-colored suit, his brown hair falling to his shoulders. The performance brings me back to show manager Dan Strickland's description of the Christmas ceremony he's seen here. If you took away the duo's instruments, it wouldn't be difficult to imagine them fitting into that midsummer ritual-like scene.
Hold me down.
The disco ball starts turning and splaying flecks of light all around the basement. Couples are dancing with each other, friends link arms, swaying in a rare moment of peace and contentment.
Surrender all your dreams to me tonight. They'll come true in the end.
Maybe something like this could have happened at other venues, but there's something special about being huddled together on Café du Nord's tiny dance floor, just inches away from these musicians pouring out so much love through their craft. In this moment, it feels like we as the audience are engaging in this shared experience that can never quite be replicated. In San Francisco, I'm Aru Nair for Cross Currents.
Aru reported that story as a member of our Summer Newsroom Fellowship. And we've got a link to Café du Nord's event calendar and more of Aru's work at klw.org/crosscurrents. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. In the history of ballet, 89-year-old George Lee is a pioneer. But if you've never heard of the dancer turned blackjack dealer, you're not alone. His obscurity led Bay Area journalist John Funabiki to tell Lee's story in the documentary 10 Times Better. In the film, Lee shares his experiences immigrating to the U.S. and making it on Broadway, starting with a groundbreaking performance in the original Nutcracker back in 1954. Funabiki spoke with KLW's Janae Darden.
John Funabiki, welcome.
Thank you so much. I'm really excited to be here with you, Janae.
I am excited to talk to you because this is an incredible story. Mr. George Lee, just an amazing story. How did the filmmakers find him?
We actually stumbled across this while we were working on and continue to work on another film called Beyond Yellow Face, which is about the history of Asian Americans in ballet. And Jennifer Lee, who's the director, was doing some research in the archives of the New York Public Library for the Performing Arts. And he discovered some photographs of and news articles and programs that mentioned this fantastic dancer named George Lee, Chinese American, who appeared in George Balanchine's first The Nutcracker.
Wow. And the title 10 Times Better comes from something that a phrase or a saying that his mother told him is something that resonates with a lot of people of color. I know in the black community, we say something similar. And in the film, we could see him doing 10 times better. I mean, first of all, he's a prodigy, right? But, he could jump higher than some of the other dancers. They talked about how he could shape their body almost like a ball, and they couldn't do that.
Exactly, yeah.
Did he realize how good he was?
Yeah, oh, that's a great question. I think he knew that he was good because this was hammered into him by his mother. Now, let's back up a little tiny bit. George Lee, born in Hong Kong, grew up in Shanghai. His father was a Chinese acrobat, and his mother was a Polish ballet dancer, a ballerina. And so from the youngest age, when he got up in the morning, his mother would train him in ballet moves. He would say, George, you need to do exactly what I do every day. And that's how he became a ballet dancer. And she was very strict, very, very, very strict in all ways, not only in his dance technique, but in his living. But his technique was just absolutely spot on. And he surprised people. But he would not brag about it. One of the interesting things about George Lee, as we came to know him during our filming process, is he's a very humble, likable man.
What also struck me about his story, or what just came up for me watching his story, is this idea of movement, and not just movement of him as a dancer, but also as an immigrant. He moved around a lot even before coming here to the United States. His experience as an immigrant, you said something, I love what you said, like about his life was twists and turns.
Yes. And, you know, like many immigrants who come to the United States, their lives were really shaped by history. So I mentioned, you know, he was born in Hong Kong, grew up in Shanghai. His father died while he was young, died in an auto accident. So he and his mother had to find a way to survive in Shanghai. And they did that by, his mother would set him up. He's a young boy, 7, 8 years old, a young boy. He would perform dances in the Shanghai nightclubs. And many of these nightclubs were Russian run, because there were many Russian immigrants living in Shanghai during this time period. So he had to learn the polka and Russian dances and things to satisfy that audience. And that he would get paid sometimes in rice. I mean, they really struggled. We were talking about being, you know, impoverished, living in Shanghai. And then as the communists started to take over China, they had to escape along with other Russian and Polish and others who were living in Shanghai. They escaped to a refugee camp in the Philippines. This was a large camp just for refugees, a tent camp. And they thought they were going to be there for a couple months maybe and then relocate, but they ended up staying there for 2 years. And then finally, they were granted permission to immigrate to the United States, and they ended up in Brooklyn. Now, all this time, he was, you know, perfecting his technique. By the time he reaches New York, he's a teenager. He goes to high school, but he is able to get into the School of American Ballet, where he's surprised to learn he's the only Chinese, the only person of color, really. And many of the instructors there are Russian ballet instructors, and they're shocked at how good he is. Life in the refugee camp must have been just, you know, amazing. And there are several images that show life in the camp, including, we were able to discover pictures of George and his mother with the other refugees. And those, I should point out, those photographs were located, I found them at the Russian Cultural Center in San Francisco. Yes, we contacted them and we said, we understand that you have some materials about this camp.
I recall in the film where he was looking for other opportunities and, you know, wanted to be in other shows, and he was turned down because of his height. Or that's what they said, right? Because he was he was so good, but they said it was because of his height.
Let's just be straight. You know, it was discrimination. It was bias. It was racism. Right.
Right. And that's what I want to ask you. Did he ever feel that he was hindered in his career because of racism and xenophobia?
In our conversations, he would never say, I was a victim of racism. This is the type of person he was. I think he held that in. But he recognized that the traditions of ballet and the biases of artistic directors and such, that in their minds, you know, male dancers were tall and white. And What I think astonishing, but maybe it's understandable. He does not speak about this in angry tones. I think he says he you'll see in the film, these are the cards that I got dealt. And it's more important is, what can I do? How can I show that I'm good?
John, thank you for bringing us this story and covering the story. Thank you so much.
Oh, we're just so grateful, one, that you've given us this opportunity to talk about the story, but also we've just loved the kind of reaction we're getting from people. Thank you.
That was film producer John Funabiki speaking with KLW's Janae Darden. That interview was co-produced by Porfirio Rangel. The documentary 10 Times Better is part of this year's San Francisco Dance Film Festival. It's showing this Saturday. We'll have all the information at klw.org/crosscurrents. Today's Cross Currents team includes Eliza Peppel, Jan Ramirez, Clara Kamunde, James Rowlands, Ganadi Joe Johnson, Victor Tense, Molly Blair Salyer, Shireen Adil, Hanisha Herjani, Marissa Ortega Welch, Angela Johnston, Lisa Morehouse, and Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet, as interpreted by Daoud Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.